This is the Blacklist Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Franklin Leonard, founder and CEO of the Blacklist, and as always, joined by
Kate Hagen, Director of Community at the Blacklist.
Our guest today, I will forever have a distinct memory of watching him as a writer of a script for Blacklist Live and an actor in said script, watching the other performers and sort of bouncing his knee, just so giddy about the fact that like Don Cheadle and Jaime Camille were reading the words that he has written. And it's cool because he is also the only person to date who has been a writer for a Blacklist Live and then been a guest on both versions of the Blacklist podcast. I am talking about just one of the most delightfully funny people I have met in my time in Hollywood, Mr. Ben Schwartz, John Ralphio himself.
As you guys will see, Ben is definitely a friend of the Blacklist family. He's such a warm and funny guy, and we're going to talk to him about a bunch of his current projects. He's a busy guy. We're going to talk a bit about his latest improv adventure with Thomas Middleditch, another Blacklist Live alum, Middleditch and Schwartz, which is currently on Netflix. We're going to talk about his voiceover work, whether that's for BB-8 in Star Wars or on the reboot of DuckTales. And we're going to talk a bit about his Stranger Than Fiction, Truer Than Real Life series, which is also currently on Netflix, Space Force.
Starring Steve Carell and Roy Wood Jr., it is darkly funny in a very specific way that it can only be in 2020. But yeah, a fun and funny interview. Here's Kate and I with Ben.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So we love to kick off every conversation by asking the same question, which is, can you remember the very first movie you saw in a movie theater? And if you could set the scene for us, that would be great.
Oh, wow. What a great question. I know the first movie that I remember forever as being like, oh, this is what movies are. That was Back to the Future. But in terms of the movie that I saw in a movie theater, I don't know. I do remember moments. Like I remember I went to see Another 48 Hours with my father and good friend Doug Henderson. And I remember being a little bit too young for that, Another 48 Hours. And I remember also me as someone who likes scripts now. I remember not seeing Eddie Murphy in so much of the beginning of that movie that I went to my dad and I go, are we in the right movie theater? And then I went to my dad's friend, Doug, and it was like getting validation from an older person being like, you know what, by the way, we may not be, like, because he didn't show up for so long that we're like, oh, we may not be in the right movie theater. But Back to the Future was the biggest one for me that cemented the idea of this is what a movie is. It was huge for me. Huge.
Do you consider that the movie that made you fall in love with movies as well?
That's it. That's the movie that I'll always go back. I travel quite a bit, as you guys do, but I travel quite a bit when I'm touring and doing work. And on my iPad, I can download a certain amount of movies because they take up so much thing. But the ones that I've downloaded always are Back to the Future 1. And then when I got a bigger iPad, I put 2 and 3 on there. And the movie Up, the Pixar film Up, and then Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is on there as well.
It's a very specific curation.
Yeah,
in a sort
it
of
is.
Ongoing way. What would a film have to do to earn its way into that group for you?
I don't know if a new movie could ever do it. It has to be movies that made me feel comfortable as a kid. Back to the Future, anytime I watch it, just makes me happy. It's like the same reason why, like, when I go to Disneyland, I'm like, I've only went once when I was a kid or whatever. But like the idea of, oh, it brings back all these memories. Watching Back to the Future again brings back all those memories and the score and all those things that made me so happy and so excited. And Up, for some reason, just was that one that broke me. That's the most recent one. But mostly they're older films that make me feel comfortable because if I'm on a plane, there's a lot of turbulence or something. It's nice to have something that calms you down.
Do you remember the first time you saw a movie? And I feel like I might know the answer to this already. When you saw yourself on screen, where you were like, oh, damn, that's me.
I think it was probably a screening of a Peep World, I think, which was me.
Not the answer I was expecting, in fairness.
It was me. That movie was stacked, by the way. It was the first lead I ever got. It blew my mind that I got it. It was me, Rainn Wilson, Sarah Silverman, Taraji P. Henson, Ron Rifkin, Leslie Ann Warren, Judy Greer, Kate Mara, Michael C. Hall. It was crazy. And I was like high on the call sheet, and I shouldn't have been. I was very young. And that was like my first lead.
The actual question, though, was, do you remember when you were a kid and saw a character who made you say, oh, shit, that's me?
But oh, I'm so
I like that answer. Here's the thing. We've asked that question of a few people who are on screen, and I keep waiting for someone to give the answer that you gave because we don't clarify. So it's a legitimate answer, and I'm going to ask both versions of the question.
I apologize. Now I feel like an asshole. Then I looked at it and said that was me. I don't know. Nothing that like totally like that I was like, oh my God, that is me. But they're like versions, characteristics of characters that I really like. Whenever I saw like a nerdy character or something like that, or I mean, people that I aspired to be, like watching Marty McFly or Ferris Bueller, like I wish I could be that cool, but I'm not that cool. I'm more Cameron than I am Ferris when I was a kid. So I don't really think I had that. I think later on through television, I found shows that I was like, holy shit, this was written for me. This TV show, not for me to star in, but this show I'm finding funny. I don't know if anybody, like the UK version of The Office, I go, holy shit. And Larry Sanders, I was like, this is, can everybody be finding in this is crazy funny? And then Freaks and Geeks I really connected with. And then on a bigger level, Simpsons, Simpsons was like what made me fall in love with writing and stuff like that.
Speaking of writing, Kate.
Yeah, I feel like, you know.
Can I also say your transitions are famous and I can't believe I was here for one of them. The alley-oop from Franklin to Kate. It's the reason why I do this podcast. I can't wait to hear when the next one's going to be.
Here's the thing about this. Kate had already set this question up. So it literally was the easiest alley-oop ever. I'm just pipping into Jordan here.
Thank you very much for the reference of the last dance. As many as you can
say,
make would make me happy.
A sports reference I get. Very exciting.
I feel like if it's a basketball reference, Kate, you're on board. Come on.
Yeah, basketball is fine. But then you start talking about football and I'm just like, I don't know, man.
Man, who needs it?
You know, we're talking a bit about The Simpsons being your gateway to writing and understanding what a writer's room does. And though so many folks know you sort of first as an actor, I think what a lot of folks don't know is that you have an incredibly extensive background in both writing and producing. That's everything from El Fuego Caliente to Saturday Night Live to Late Night with David Letterman to the Oscars to Jake and Amir. So I'm wondering how your writer-producer brain has informed your actor brain and how your actor brain has informed your writer-producer brain?
That's a great question. And I will say, just because we're here starting it, that I'd sold 2 scripts, I think, before I got picked up by The Blacklist. And being picked up by The Blacklist, especially then, man, it was a huge deal to validate me as a writer because everybody kind of saw me as a actor. And it's a little bit harder to get taken seriously as a writer, especially for the characters I was playing. Maybe if John Ralph is a little crazy, you know what I mean? Stuff like that to be like, oh, but also like I've been working on writing for a long time, but it's a big deal and a benchmark to get on The Blacklist, as I assume it must still be, just now that I see that there's so many people that you guys have turned into a huge, it's been kind of incredible. I've been rooting you guys along the whole way, but it's like, it's kind of incredible how you've turned this thing into like a full-on business and also a business that helps pull each other up, which never happens.
I sort of joke about the fact that like, thank God the industry didn't pay attention to writers for as long as they did, because it left an opportunity to build a business that could actually be a tide that raises all boats, and we just happened to do it. But yeah, it's good. Thank you for the kind words. I will send you a check next week.
Thank you very much. I don't even remember your question because I got so lost.
It's
in
a good
the love
okay,
fest.
Kate, just ask the end of the question again.
Oh yeah, how does your writer producer brain inform your actor brain, and how does your actor brain inform your writer producer brain?
So I think there's different versions of this for each different thing. It's a great question. One is my producer brain from producing a couple things now. I'm more cognizant of how are we going to make this day when I shouldn't be. Sometimes I put pressure on myself when I'm acting in something. It's like when I did earlier show and I was directing and producing it, I was like, okay, I know I only have this much time. I have to get this done. And you're constantly fighting that. And then as an actor, I can look at the call sheet and see if I'm going to get fucked on a certain day and be like, oh, they put me, which happens a lot, especially on television, where they'll put me up in the last scene and I know we're barely going to make the day. That means I'll get 1 or 2 takes. You know what I mean? And oftentimes I'm not number 1 on the call sheet. So I'm getting 1 response. You know what I mean? Like, so it's like, Like, I can break it down that way. Improv in writing has been one of the biggest things. If you guys watch those specials, we have these specials on Netflix, and it's Milos and Schwartz. And if you watch those specials, someone broke them down in a script notes fashion as if it was a script. You could see the way that I write films, it translates to that, because I'm oftentimes dealing with a lot of story and structure, and I'll see where I can play with the three-act structure and see where I can play with the growth of characters throughout the whole things, and that becomes a huge deal. My writing has influenced my improv a ton, and then my improv influences my writing a ton because I learned how to write dialogue rather quickly, because that's in improv, if you're doing long form correctly, it's kind of just scene work, and oftentimes it's two-person scene work, so you kind of learn the rhythm and the cadence and you kind of find your voice through that.
I actually wanted to ask about that. When you're
did doing... you guys watch it? Be honest.
I did, which is why
I had some friends who went to a taping as well. Great. So they saw you live. Yeah.
Really? Oh, that makes me very happy. Thank you, guys.
But so I'm sort of fascinated by this notion of long form improv, which I will admit not having really any exposure to prior to watching the specials. As a writer, right? Like in creating this improv, are you just in the moment and just doing scene work and sort of trusting that like you'll sort of be able to sort of swing from vine to vine, scene to scene? Or how much of is your brain thinking about like the macro structure of the entire long form thing as you're doing it?
By the way, I've never heard the phrase swinging from vine to vine, and it's a great way of explaining what improv is, because it's literally flying and going forward and then trying to see what else you can grab onto. And that is what it is. It's split second decisions, and it's just a series of them over and over and over again. But what I will do is, like you saw the wedding episode, so I can use an example of that. Thomas comes in just to shake shit up and says he's a ghost in one of the things. So what I do as a writer is I take that character, I put it in the back of my brain, and in long form improv, there's no mistakes. And when something happens, there's no mistakes. Like if a siren goes off outside and you hear it, you can incorporate it. Everything is a part of the show. So in my head, I was like, okay, that ghost, if I can find a place to put that ghost in there, and you know, that feels like it makes sense, like that's why we saw that ghost, then I could pay it off. So those are the things that I keep in the back of my head. And then the only other thing that I do in terms of any, there's no planning, but like I'll look at the clock and see how much time we have left. And if I see we have like 10 minutes left, my brain will start racking ways to connect as much as I can to get us to at least a third set piece or a third act, something to wrap us up. Sometimes it works, sometimes it's just you can't do it. But if you see the connection, like that's when you start doing it, because the audience is with you the entire way. They're learning everything the second you're learning everything. So if you call back that ghost character, which half the people forgot about, they're like, oh, you know what I mean? And you've experienced it together because we're writing it together right then. That's kind of how we do it. But outside of that, it's vine to vine. Once we start, we have no idea if it's going to be in one location. We have no idea if it's going to be a lot of locations. If somebody starts, maybe they're like fawning for someone, I'll think of, okay, you know, don't have them fall in love so quickly where now what do we do in our show? You know what I mean? So that type of stuff, but literally nothing is planned.
What kind of preparation are you guys doing for that? I mean, again, just as sort of like for a long form improv thing, is it just that you've sort of trained yourself, you know, as an improv athlete, that you're just like,
yeah, that's exactly correct.
In the arena, let's just do it. Is there any sort of preparation other than like, yeah, I've been doing this for years, right? Like
the beginning of it is when we got like coaches, I don't know if you guys ever did improv or Kate, you ever went to any improv shows or whatever, but it's, no, both of them said no, like really
no,
sternly.
I'm not an improv.
I've been to many improv shows. I was shaking my head too. I've never done improv, but anybody who lives in LA has many friends who have done improv. Come on.
Yeah, I've been to a few improv shows and literally nobody wants me to do improv.
I remember we did an ad once. We did a commercial, Franklin and I, for the Blacklist thing. And yeah. Franklin was just like, ugh, like we did like five takes. And I forget what happened. I just remember me laughing so much.
What happened was I was terrible. I was like the Alec Baldwin ad in the 30 Rock pilot where he's, you know, I don't know where to put my hands.
Right.
Like it was so awful. And I'm sorry to have put
you through
that.
No, I loved it.
But the live read turned out well. And in many ways, my being absolutely wooden was a nice tonic to your being
the perfect straight man to the crazy person.
Exactly. But yeah, preparation. Is there any? Or do you just go?
So the preparation is exactly what you said. It's the 20 years of doing improv before. When we first started, we would do, not we, but like as a group of eight on a Harold team, you do all these exercises. Then you do like word things with each other to just try to get each other's mind sharp. Literally what Thomas and I do when we have a show at Largo, we arrive at the theater 5 minutes before we go on stage. We say hello to each other. We put on our microphones. We talk about what happened. And maybe if they have to push 5 minutes because the audience is still coming in, we'll go on our cell phones, not talk to each other for a bit and just talk to each other. And then literally go out and that's it. We don't do anything. thing. And same with like when we did Carnegie Hall, same when we did these specials, we just talk to each other. We go on our phones if we're doing two shows in one night, which is a lot because it's just two people on stage for a very long time. We'll just chill in the middle and like relax, but there's no exercises. And when we started, we did a ton of exercises before, not me and Thomas, but you know, my old teams, we would do a ton of exercises to get ourselves like warmed up. And then Thomas and I are just like, let's just go out there and see what happens.
Is there any kind of come down from those shows? Do you have to sort of recalibrate to rejoin the normal world afterwards?
It's so funny. These are great questions. It's not a sense of calibration to get myself associated with the real world. Like, oh my God, I'm so in this character of a wizard who goes inside another wizard's asshole. But it's like, it's not like I got to shake that off somehow. It's like, it's a very, once you went on tour, and this is something that I'm assuming musicians feel in a 20,000 way, it's that we'll perform for like 3,000 people and we're getting very fortunate on these shows and people are really enjoying them and we'll get a standing ovation, you know what I mean? And let's say we're in, we're in Philly. We get a standing ovation if we're lucky and everybody goes crazy and we've just made stuff up and we're exhausted. We're so excited. And I'm not really a party guy. You know what I mean? I don't really go out. I don't do anything. So I'll come back to the hotel and it's such a funny thing from when we say thank you, good night to maybe 35 minutes later when I'm dragging our own sound equipment home because we don't have a tour manager. I literally have it in a backpack and I go home. Oh no, I don't have it in a backpack. I have it in the laundry bag of whatever hotel I'm staying in. And I take it home. Then I'm just by myself. And it's just like, it's such a funny thing. Like 35 minutes from that to watching SportsCenter or going on YouTube or going on Twitter and just like being nonsense. Like, and the first couple times that you like, when you're younger and you're doing shows, you gotta like, people go to a bar and just hang out and stuff like that. But once you get older, it's just like, you know, we gotta travel at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. Let me get back home. You just get the bigness of it. You find a way to just realize, those people enjoyed it. Now back to the real world. Nobody knows what the fuck just happened. I'm just walked down the street and nobody knows that we just did a show. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I imagine it's gotta be quite a process, especially, you know, as you're like, I need a full 8 hours of sleep so I can perform better tomorrow. No 200 Bud Lights for me.
Exactly.
I'm going to direct us back to the questionnaire and ask about your ideal movie watching vibe. Obviously, we can't go to movie theaters right now, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious about what your ideal sort of movie theater situation is and what your at-home watching situation is. Where are you sitting? What kind of snacks?
I'm very excited we're doing this, by the way. I just realized how excited. And also, I never get to talk about writing or anything. Very few people know. By the way, I'll get to that card, but just reminded me. I sold this movie to Searchlight, which is the sixth studio movie I've sold to Searchlight for. It's me and Sam Rockwell are starring in it, and I'm writing it right now. And two of the articles said, Ben Schwartz makes feature writing debut. And I was like, oh, just nobody knows that it's such a funny thing. Nobody knows or that I've ever directed or anything like that. But I remember just because I get to talk to you guys about this, it was such a weird feeling of being like, oh no, I've been writing for like 12 years, like selling movies for 12 years, and I wrote 4 books and da da da. But whatever, from my movie experience since I've been to LA, it's going to the Arclight Hollywood. I oftentimes like to go to on the aisle just so I can go to the bathroom if I want, but now I've learned since watching so many movies there to get closer to the center, usually get popcorn, no butter, and put like some sort of M&Ms in it, shake them up, and have just the water. But I don't drink too much of the water because I do not want to go to the bathroom during the movie, and that is my experience. But the Arclight has been very kind to me. I love that theater.
Any particulars when you're watching a movie at home? Any particular rituals?
I strip down naked. I just have one sock on. I put on the biggest hat I can find. I open up all the windows and I blast it. Let's say it's The Pianist or Schindler's List. Those are the only two movies I have at home. Those are the ones that I really blast. No, what do I do? I it's just like trying to get it as dark as possible. And the room where my TV is, it has a high ceiling, so the sound doesn't carry very well. And every time I watch something, I'm always like, I gotta figure out a way so I can hear it better. And I never do. But that's it. And also, like, as a treat, sometimes I'll like rent a movie for $3.99. Like, that's like a treat to me because I'll first go through all like Netflix and Amazon Prime and all the things I already pay for, and then like I just watched The Hunt the other day, and then like that was like $19, and I was like, you know what, I'd be spending that if I went to the movie theater, and I'd probably see this in a movie theater anyway. So
the only thing I've done that far in quarantine so far is Cats, which was $20 well spent.
What did you think of Cats?
Cats was incredible. I love a bad movie that is really, really bad, and like just the uncanny valley-ness of Cats. Like, I cannot wait to watch it again. Wow. We're speaking of strange movie adventures. We like to ask.
Tough transition, Kate. You had it on the first one. That was a fucking bumpy ride to get to be on that one.
We like to ask about the weirdest circumstances under which you've ever watched a movie.
Oh, I have an answer for this.
Excellent. We would love to hear it.
The Net, Sandra Bullock. Remember the movie The Net with Sandra Bullock? I was with my movie. So how old must I have been? Franklin, are we the same age kind of? I'm 38.
I think I'm like 3 years older than you are.
Okay, you're a little bit older. Close. I wonder how, I don't know when The Net came out, but it would be great to find like whatever year we can Google.
1995.
I was going to say 94.
I'm 14. I'm either 13 or 14 years old, right? That means I'm a bar mitzvah boy. I am a man at this point. We're at the movie theater and I grew up in Riverdale, the top of the Bronx. So for a long time, before I moved to Westchester, we'd go to the same movie theater in the Bronx to watch all of our movies. And we're watching The Net. It might have been Doug Henderson again. Me, my dad, and Doug Henderson, I think. And I see an usher come down. And I've never seen an usher come down in the middle of a movie ever. I'm like, what is going on? And the usher comes down and they go after someone. They like grab somebody. And the guy does not want to move. And fucking The Net is on in front of me. Like they haven't shut off the thing. The Net is on. It's funny how you like, I vividly remember exactly where I was and where, because it was such a traumatic event because movie theater, so much crappy shit has happened since then, but it's such a safe place. You go there, the lights shut off and it's your imagination takes over. And like, I love JJ's line of like, the most exciting part of the movie is like when it's just like complete darkness and you have no idea what the fuck is about to happen. So this is a perfect example of, I had no idea what the fuck. An usher comes down, never seen it before in this Bronx place. Ask someone to get up. They don't get up. They try to grab me. Done. The person is drunk and I had no idea. And they get him up. He has a handle of vodka. His pants were around his ankles. He was jerking off to Sandra Bullock in like the second row of this movie theater.
Oh my God.
And they drag him out. And then I was like, what the fuck? And my dad tried to explain it like a father, being like, he was masturbating in the front row. And I was like, it was such a funny moment. But I'll never forget, like, that was such a crazy thing. Also, when we moved to Westchester, the movie Airheads came out. And me and my friends went to see it at Movieland. And nobody else was in the theater. And it was my first time ever being in a movie theater where nobody else was there. So it was just me and my three high school friends. And we fucking ran up and down the aisle. We sat in every seat. It was the most exciting time of my life.
I saw the movie Mars Attacks.
Oh, great film.
And I was the only, me and my friends were the only one in the theater and we did the exact same thing. And it was a seminal moment of my childhood.
You remember it, right? Because it's just like, it's never happened before where you're the only people in a movie theater.
And then you're just like, yep, that entitles us to do literally whatever we want. It's like all the rules of sort of normal human decorum are off, which I think is maybe true when you're like a teenage boy anyway.
Right.
But it's just like, here is an extra excuse to wild out.
Oh, it was magic. I remember it so clearly. And also the fact that the movie was Mars Attacks or Airheads, it's not like, This is fair that we can be running around and still enjoying the film and being fine.
I think I was also one of the only people in the theater when I saw the movie Nixon in high school, which I saw because we got extra credit.
That's a hot Friday night in 1995, baby, going to see 3 hours of Nixon.
We've talked at length about my lack of a social life in high school on this podcast. We can move on.
What did you spend time with mostly instead of that? Was it video games or movies?
Oh, no. It was movies and math. That was basically my high school.
I love math. AP math. High school. My favorite subject.
AP Calc, BC. That was basically my high school life. Not much has changed, in fairness.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
All right.
Speaking of some of our favorite math nerds, I want to to talk a bit about the Parks and Rec reunion special, which I think was one of the most welcome respites throughout this entire quarantine period, and is still raising money for food banks, which is really incredible. So hats off to all you guys. That's the kind of work that I feel like a lot of quote unquote celebrities should be doing rather than complaining about being in their mansions. But, you know, just a thought.
As I lean into my tiny closet trying to get good audio for you.
But I want to know what it was like to return to that world under these really unique, sort of unprecedented set of circumstances. And how did you guys, meaning the cast, sort of collaborate with the writing staff to bring Pawnee back to life in this sort of, you know, behind a computer screen way?
Yeah. So Mike Schur emailed me, said, hey, we're going to do a park special. We'd love for you to be in it. Do you want to be in it? And I was like, what are you insane? Of course, whatever you want, always. And so said, okay, they wrote the script in like 3 or 4 days, I heard. And if you look at the credits, the people on the script are like a bunch of the writers from Parks back in the day, and they're just geniuses. That writing staff, I think, will go down in history as one of the greatest all-time TV writing staffs of all time.
Oh, no. Amram, Aisha Muharrar, like, it's banana.
It's
like,
insane.
Literally completely
Harris,
insane.
Harris, Allen, it's crazy. And so they gave me the script, and I had like, you know, I'm in it a little bit, and so, a very little bit. And so what had happened, which you'll find fascinating, was they said, okay, so Doug Smith, who's one of the guys who works on the show, is going to drop off a box in front of your house. Take out of the box, this is what's going to be. And what it is, you know, those, like, they're called it's a tripod that's called like Gorilla Arm or something like that, because it like grabbed, you know, that tripod?
Yeah.
I think that's the real name of the thing. So it's like, we're going to give you one of those, and we're going to give you an iPhone 11. And on the iPhone 11, there's going to be a little microphone, and there's going to be a little light. And then you're going to set that up. And then in my box, that came in, instructions how to set it up. And then fake money, just a bunch of fake money. And then like a really weird pink, like Hawaiian shirt that I wore underneath a purple tux. And that was all that came in my box. I got it. I washed everything down. Just like we're doing here, I put them on Zoom to the left out of frame. And it was Mike Schur, Morgan Sackett, and Dean Holland, the editor. And Mike and Morgan gave me direction as I did it for their iPhone. I cannot tell you how quick it went. Did it. I did it the day after Easter or the day of Easter. Did it. And then he goes, hey, can you take some pictures around your house where there's nothing that you can't see, so it looks like you're totally... Because I was doing it, and the sound, because it's the same place I watch movies, the ceilings were too high, so all my sound sounded like whatever. So we made a bit out of it saying that there's nothing on my walls and stuff like that. And so then he goes, take pictures around your house of you, whatever. And then take a picture of you like this, and we're going to, it's me being very upset or like happy and stiff, and we're going to put a neck brace on you. We're going to CGI neck brace. I did that all, took no time at all. I put it in the box, put the box outside, texted Morgan Sackett. Someone picked it up 5 minutes later, and that was it. That was the whole thing.
Wow.
It was crazy.
It really is extraordinary. Because the numbers do just keep racking up for like what you guys did. But it's funny too, because I remember thinking like, this is the one show that I actually want to see a pandemic episode from.
I think it's because she's so positive and kind. And Leslie is like, she's, that show nowadays would be such a relief. But I think you're right. I think those reasons are up there for it.
All right, so we're going to switch it up and talk about your favorite movies.
Great.
On a few different fronts. So first question, are there any films in the so-called cinematic canon, the films that are great films by reputation, that you just refuse to watch?
Refuse to watch?
Yeah, where you're just like, nope, can't do it, not interested.
No, I'll always give it a shot. The only thing that makes me stop is if the runtime is very long, because you have to be in the mood. Like when we're watching a movie, it's like if it's 2 hours or less, yeah, we can always pop that in whenever. But if it's like really want to watch Reds, and every time it's like nighttime during the pandemic and we're like, we should watch Reds, it's like, you can't. Yeah. It's harder to commit. But then like, so those longer ones, even though I really want to watch them, those are the ones. But I'm using the quarantine time to catch up on old movies, like Taking a Pelham 1-2-3 with Matthau and Jerry Stiller, who just passed away, unfortunately. But like, that movie's unbelievable. And I'd never seen it before. And then I'm starting to go through all these movies that I'd never seen before. And there's like a huge list, because I didn't know that you could be an actor or a writer as a kid. Like that, none of my friends were those things. So it wasn't until after college that I was like, holy shit, maybe I can do this. And I really tried to get more into it.
I will say, Reds has a very helpful intermission in the middle. So if you want to watch half and then save the other half, there you go.
Excuse me.
Kate Hagen is endless fonts of valuable knowledge on cinema. There's really no other way to say
it.
Can you name two other movies with an intermission?
Barry Lyndon and Gone with the Wind. Yeah.
Gone with the Wind is correct.
Honestly, my thought was, I mean, challenge her at least. Like, come on. Like,
I will by the end of this.
Please. All right. Any of the films that you've been watching, were they ones that you had initially like resisted for some reason and you're watching it now and you're just like, oh my God, I literally destroyed my own life by not watching this.
It was never like I tried to purposely not watch it. It was more like I just never got to it. And then it felt like Game of Thrones. I've never seen an episode of Game of Thrones. And
wow.
It just seems so impossible to catch up that I don't think I'll ever catch up. You know what I mean?
Something tells me you will at some point.
This would be the time. If I ever was going to catch up.
If there ever was a time, this would be the time. Also, before the inevitable Twitter shaming that happens when this interview drops.
No. I really do. I can't wait to watch it.
What's a movie that everyone thinks is terrible that you will defend forever?
Oh, what a great question.
So we're talking sub 20% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, I mean, Kate, throw me, I don't even know what would be sub 20%.
I mean, you don't have to know that it's sub 20, but like, we all know what a terrible movie is, and we all know which ones we defend.
Like, Hot Rod has like a terrible Rotten Tomatoes score, which makes no
sense. Oh, there's
no
gotta be comedies from the 90s that I absolutely obsessed over, and Ace Ventura 1, 2, but everybody thinks those are incredible.
I feel like Ace Ventura 1 probably has a very high Rotten Tomatoes score. Ace Ventura 2, maybe not.
Great movie. By the way, you know what I love, and I've said on a podcast before and got yelled at by James Gunn, mind you, someone I respect more than most filmmakers, that I think Back to the Future 3 is a better movie than Back to the Future Part 2.
I would need to review them before I can have a strong opinion on this. It has been too long.
My spiciest to the Future take is that both of the sequels are better than the original.
That is literally... That is... I am so upset right now. The fact that you could... You fucking... Kate, listen to me. You... It's like someone, you don't understand what movies are. Let me start with that.
I know it's like objectively incorrect, but like personal taste-wise, that's where I'm at.
I was wondering if that was going to come up because I feel like Kate recently tweeted this take and defended it and avoided the worst of the scolding. But
oh,
I feel
no,
like
this is like, there's nothing you could say that makes me more upset.
No, I did because I was like, I am missing something with the Back to the Future movies because they have never really resonated with me. And I love 80s teen movies. So I rewatched 1 and 2 a couple weekends ago and I was like, yep, 13-year-old me agrees with 30-year-old me. I still like the second one better.
What's a movie that you saw as a kid but now that you're an adult, you're like, holy shit, I was wrong. This is great.
Oh, that's interesting. What did I just rewatch? Not like a kid's movie, but I had seen Brick in high school and did not like it. And then I saw it a year ago again and I was like, teenage me was an asshole. Brick is awesome. I don't know what I was thinking.
Oh, it's Franklin?
I'm trying to think about it. I think I liked most movies as a kid. Like there wasn't much that I didn't like respond positively to because it was like a movie. I'm trying to think of anything that I like really dogged out when I was younger. There's a lot more things that I liked as a kid that as an adult I'm like, what were you thinking?
There are some movies that you rewatch like, oh boy.
Yeah. Ace Ventura 2 definitely qualifies. It is a 31 on Rotten Tomatoes, which it's not 20, but it's still not great. I'm actually surprised to find that the original Ace Ventura is a 48. And I definitely would have thought it would have fallen into the category of sort of big, broad, silly movies that critics responded to. But, you know, it's weird how almost 30 years of remove does that to your brain.
Three Amigos is incredible. I think that's an incredible movie. I bet that doesn't have above 70. I think that's just still an incredible movie. Yeah, I just rewatched that recently and was like, oh God, it's just the funniest people being funny. How fun is that?
As a general rule, that's a great way to put together a movie. Yeah, Three Amigos, 46 on Rotten Tomatoes.
That's my choice then. I love that movie. It's a great movie.
That's crazy.
Final answer, accepted.
There's also movies that before I moved to LA, I didn't get quite as much, like LA Story, now that I rewatched that. It's like,
there are a lot of those.
Oh my God, there's so many, because I'm just like a New York kid and I didn't know anything about this industry. And then slowly you learn I remember like watching Adaptation twice in a row being like, holy shit, this is amazing. Like I remember there's very few movies in my life where I watch something and have to watch it from the beginning again, because I was like, oh, I want to watch it now in this light. And I think Charlie Kaufman is probably responsible for most of those.
Mulholland Drive would be a movie that I saw when I was younger in my early 20s and did not get. And I think now living in LA, it has changed my point of view on it.
I've never seen Mulholland Drive.
I recommend, especially living in LA, especially right now. Definitely check it out.
I'm putting together a list of movies that people recommend to me. If you want to email me, Franklin, I would love that. I asked,
honestly,
like,
the smart call is to ask Kate here.
Kate, I would love that. Kate.
If you want more downer 70 stuff, like Taking a Pelham 1-2-3, that's like extremely my shit. So I am available.
Well, I did a Condor. What's it called?
Something 3 Days of the Condor.
3 Days of the Condor. Oh, yeah. I watched. I just
classic.
Yeah, so like we're going through that. If you have recommendations, email me.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to recommend the shit out of Clute. Yep.
Oh, Clute. Jane Fonda, no?
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
I've done two movies with her.
All right, next question. We call it the Sydney Pollack question because Sydney said that he was only ever interested in making movies about two subjects, love and war, because they're the only two subjects that we're no closer to understanding in all of human history. So, favorite movie about love and favorite movie about war.
Oh, man. Ugh. These are so hard. I wish I'd thought about any. I wish I knew about any of these. This is one of those things that.
That's why we spring it on you to get the real shit.
Yeah, but to get like the panic answer, like the Notebook, and I've never even seen the Notebook.
We can also come back to this one at the end if you want to take a beat to think
that's
about
true.
It.
No,
if you
wanna, if I you will pause. Not. I love Saving Private Ryan. I think it's pretty incredible. I think that's a good movie about war, and then love. I mean, I love the bromance in Shawshank Redemption. The idea of the two leads in that. That hit me so... I love that film, even as a kid. And my dad loved that film also. I remember like having a pride when I found a movie that I loved that my dad liked as well. I was like, oh yeah. The love between those two characters, Morgan Freeman and Tim Robbins. Or I watched The Player again. That's another LA one that if you've been in the industry for longer, whatever.
It's true. It's definitely true. I like those answers. Saving Private Ryan and Shawshank. Unexpected. Take it.
In addition to creating some of the most iconic comedy characters of the last decade, we were just talking about Jean Ralphio. You've shared your many talents behind animated characters as well as Sonic the Hedgehog, yes. A Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, part of the DuckTales revival, and a consultant for the one and only Beep Beep 8, as I like to call him. What's your favorite part of creating a vocal performance for a character, and how do you sort of infuse your personality into those characters?
My favorite thing is that I get to be as the most exaggerated version of myself as I can, and someone who grew up on animated films and animated television, watching Disney Afternoon every day when I was a kid, the idea that I get to be like the new generation of Dewey Duck or the new generation of Leonardo, and that's how a kid maybe falls in love with Turtles or DuckTales, blows my... It makes me so excited. And that's why Sonic was such a big deal, because Sonic was obviously in a bunch of TV shows, and Jaleel White voiced him, and Roger Craig Smith, and Jason Gray, all these great people have voiced Sonic, but they never made a film. So the fact that I could be the first film version of a character is like... That was... crazy. I still can't believe that that one's such a big deal. It's also like the first time ever that I played the character that was the name of the movie and you never see my face. It was a very interesting thing. I will say, which I've talked about a little bit, was that because this is The Blacklist, I wrote jokes for both episode 7 and episode 9 of Star Wars, and that was crazy too. But seeing my name in the credits of episode 7, fucking... I almost cried when we were at the premiere. I almost cried just seeing my name in the font of the credits was enough. That like, and I knew it was coming, and it didn't matter. And I was like, and everybody's looking at me because I'm not in the movie. They're like, what the fuck is this guy getting so emotional about? So it was a very interesting. It was crazy.
Well, I remember seeing you there and being like, wait a minute, is Ben in this movie?
Yeah, I feel like everybody was wondering where the fuck I was there.
Actually, yes.
To talk about it before that moment either. It was a secret until the credits came out. And then, you know, the only people who saw it were probably Franklin because he watches the credits of the movie, but nobody watches credits anymore.
I feel like the internet discovered that with you and Bill Hader on the same day and was like, wait a minute, excuse me, what?
Crazy.
We're so lucky.
Crazy.
So lucky. Speaking about things in space, Space Force comes to Netflix.
Oh, wow. Kate, you still got it, kid.
You know, pulling it back around for the end. What can I say?
Yeah.
Space Force is coming.
It's almost over. We're done.
We're getting towards the end. Totally.
It's very sad. This is my last thing of the day. We could talk forever if you want.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Face Force is coming to Netflix on May 29th, and it's another collaboration with Greg Daniels after Parks and Rec. Mm-hmm. And it feels like the sort of comfy, cozy, yet still totally batshit workplace comedy we really need right now. We all need to laugh. When you're working on this kind of ripped from the headlines series, do you tune out current events to serve the fictional world that you're kind of immersed in? Or are you fuel the surreality of the series as crazy things are happening in the world?
I mean, especially given your sort of role in the show, like, it feels like particularly ripped from the headlines. I don't know how much we're allowed to talk about, like, who you are in the Space Force, but it's just like, in a world of messaging, let's say,
nice.
How, like, do you think about, like, the reality of messaging that's coming out of the White House in this administration as you think about, like, or is it just a totally separate thing?
It's totally separate. And I think the way that they got lucky is the second that someone announced that Space Force existed, they like sold the show. Like I remember watching this. I watched the trailer for this a year ago before they were even auditioning people. Remember, it was just like, oh, text over whatever the people. And I was like, oh, that's a great idea. And I think what's so crazy about this is that while our show is coming out concurrently, things are going to be happening. Like they introduced their camos and we already filmed our scenes with our camos. So we're like, oh, and these are what our camos look like. And then they show their emblem. And then Greg is like, this is what our emblem. It's so fucking weird. And then I just recently talked to someone and it made me realize that, you know, all these things are real positions. Like someone has my position of the media manager of the Space Force. And that's the person who's probably tweeting out all the videos and making the video. And like, and it's a very surreal, crazy thing. And I hope the good news is we didn't know any of this stuff when I wasn't on the writing staff, but you know, none of that stuff existed yet when they were writing the script.
Right.
So they were just, you know, taking the idea of what this is and let's parrot, you know, let's find what the funniness is and that, the funny aspect of that. But it's going to be very surreal that like things are happening in real life and then our show is going to come out and it's going to mirror something just for the sake of it being a real thing that exists in the world. It's kind of crazy.
I mean, this is actually something that I've thought about a lot in the last 3 years. Like, is Armando Iannucci ever going to be able to work again? Right? Like, in a world where you're trying to satire the sort of American political system and it feels like it's beyond satire. I'm curious, as a comedy writer generally, and I don't necessarily think of you as being a comedy writer who's particularly political per se, but I also know that you're very engaged in the world around you. Like, how does one joke about what feels like a joke?
I don't know. Sometimes it can't. Sometimes the parody would have to be so big it becomes a cartoon or something like that. And also you'll see when people do impressions of certain people in politics that is the only way to get the laughs. The laughs have to be that they're so insane. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. I'm not quite certain. I do know that I ask you too because you have a lot of knowledge on this, but I can't tell if after this, like I'm writing this Rockwell movie now and it has nothing to do with the current climate because I sold it before all this happened, but I don't know the appetite that people will have to have movies that are about the coronavirus or that bring up that 60% of the movies, like I know for me, if, you know, Spike Jonze or if, you know, Taika or somebody does like a movie, a filmmaker, I'll go see a movie because a filmmaker made it. But I do not have an appetite to watch movies about what we just went through or that we're currently going through. And I wonder what that's going to be, because obviously the first 2 days before we knew how long it was going to take, everybody had, you know, the same idea of a quarantine TV show. Like I remember like three of my friends like, what about this? I was like, yeah, we all have the fucking same idea. Like there's no way. I just don't know. What do you guys, because we have nothing to match this up with, a disaster that's so global. But what are your thoughts on writing going forward? Do scripts have to mention it if it's about... If it's a script that takes place in 2020, do you have to mention it because it's a part of what happened, or how do you deal with it?
I mean, my instinct is that everything that gets made after this moment is in its own way about this moment, whether it's directly commented on or not, right? Like, you know, everybody talks about like, oh, I'm going to write my King Lear during the pandemic, or I'm going to discover calculus during the pandemic, right? Like, at the end of the day, like, all you have to do during the pandemic to be a productive creative is to survive. Because whatever you're going to write after this is going to be informed by the experience of having lived through this. And so that's the pandemic art that I'm most interested in, is the stuff that like just is part of the processing of this moment. Look, there are going to be some great storytelling and art that comments directly on this moment, right? Like if Bong Joon-ho comes out with a pandemic movie, I'm there opening night.
That's exactly correct.
Even in a packed theater, I'm risking it. That's just how I feel about director Bong. But if anybody coughs, I'll leave, and be, it shouldn't have to be like that. But separately, like, so yeah, like there's no reason to not write the pandemic thing if you feel strongly that you're going to write the best thing ever. But, you know, there's going to be a lot more really bad pandemic stuff, and maybe find a way to talk about what it means to you and what it means to the world in a way that's a metaphor. It's a rarely used literary device that we all benefit from exploring. Like, look, this is why zombie movies are so interesting to me, because when done well, they're all metaphors, right? Mm-hmm. And how you do it allows us to sort of figure out how we feel about these other things. So that's probably the stuff I'm most looking forward to. But, you know, if somebody wants to be in their bag and make a pandemic thing and it's dope, and I hear from other people that it's dope, of course I'll go see it. But the bar is extremely high. I think
that's what it is. I think you're right that there's going to be a lot of, it's like, yeah, it's going to be a lot of content. The one thing as a writer, the thing that scares me right now, what I've been hearing from people is like, oh, what's your animated movie? What's your animated TV show? Those are the things we can get in production right now. And I'm like, fuck, I'm trying to write the movie. You know what I mean? But I think there's going to be such a backlog of scripts. It's going to be very hard to sell things when we get out of this, because I think it's going to be hard to film for a while. And if we do film, it's going to be very stripped down. I was supposed to direct a movie that I wrote in June or July, and now that's going to be moved. But the idea of what those movies are, because it's like a small two or under movie, and it's like, you know, the movie I've been writing for 10 years. I started this, my first cover page of it was 10 years ago. And it's like a small movie that we can do with a small crew and one location, blah, blah, blah. But I was just even talking to someone, like, if Space Force gets picked up again, we would film the second you're allowed to film again. But what does that even look like? Do we all have to go into quarantine together for 2 weeks as a group with the crew? And then we can only use one location? You can't have any guest stars? Like, I'm so curious. The thing that terrifies me the most about all this, outside of the idea that, you know, at any moment, anybody you know could pass away, is that there's no end date. There's no final end date. No. Like, you know what? If we make it to June 1st, everybody, hold on tight. You know, it's like doing a wall sit. You just get to 60 seconds and you can stand up and you're done. It's like, there, by the way, I worked out once. I don't know why I use the term wall sit. But like, that's the thing that scares me the most. And the thing that I think oftentimes, like, people who are religious, like, that's what they use religion for, the unknown answers. Like, you know what I mean? Like, so that's the thing that gives me the most anxiety. Like, when does this end and what does the world look like when it ends? But in terms of writers, I think it's going to be very interesting, because there's going to be so much material. And the people who didn't have time to write shit, the really talented people who like get paid a ton of money to write it, they're going to have a bunch of shit. So the stuff that we're writing to people that aren't as big as those people, I don't know how easy it's going to be to sell stuff. I'm not quite certain what it looks like. It's kind of sad. I remember also, I might have talked to both of you guys about this when I did A Fuego Caliente. I came in, I started selling scripts. My first producer or second producer told me, if I'd come to LA 5 years earlier, the landscape of selling comedies would have been so different, and it would have been such a bigger deal that I was able to write these. But the idea that, you know, at the beginning, I mostly wrote like $10 to $15 million comedies, nobody makes them anymore. So nobody's buying them anymore. So it's harder to sell them. And it's so like everything is changing. And I saw that changing, and then streaming, like everything's changing. Now this will be another huge change. I don't know exactly what it means for anybody.
I do think one of the great things about this time is we're all realizing how much we need oral traditions, how much we need storytelling. And like, that's never going away. Like whether it's, you know, a Marvel movie or a Zoom call, like we need to share stories to stay alive and to connect with each other. And I think the things that are going to be most successful coming out of this are going to be the things that address it without addressing it directly. Like, I'm very excited about what the next 10 years of horror movies and thrillers look like. I think you'll get a lot of allegorical stuff that, you know, like you were saying, zombie movies, but I think people will even get more clever than that in terms of like, how can we talk about this thing without actually talking about it?
And there's also stuff like in stuff that I have a couple things that I'm playing with right now, but that started before this. And then while you're rereading it, you're like, oh shit, this could lead into blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? Like exactly what you said, using it as you said the word metaphor. I've never heard it before. Mutaphor.
Yeah, that's it.
Mutaphor. Okay, cool. But I think that that's like going back on my things that I've already already like done the outlines for. I'm like, oh shit, this could be looked upon as da-da-da, which is so funny that you can write something in some way. And then like 5-10 years later or whatever it is, you can rewatch it again. You're like, holy shit, this is a perfect blank for blank. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Going back to The Net, Angela Bennett, original work from home hero.
Angela, who's Angela Bennett?
That's Sandra Bullock's character. Sandra Bullock's character. She worked from home and telecommuted to San Francisco, says Wikipedia.
She worked from home and she's still able to get harassed in the second row of a Bronx theater.
Exactly. Actually, I think this sort of conversation about the value of cinema is a perfect wind down to our final two questions. I'll ask one and then Kate will ask the last one. Here we go. Ben, what is the single image from cinema that will stay with you for the rest of your life?
The DeLorean flying away at the end of Back to the Future 1. Always. And by the way, the way that it did it. And God damn it, Kate, if you ruin this for me, I will shut this Zoom off.
I'm not going to ruin it. Back to the Future is a very fun movie that does not connect with me.
Oh, God, get out of here, Grandma.
Personally.
Wow.
It's fine.
The condescension.
My God.
I'm sure there are many, like, B-tier Molly Ringwald movies from the 80s that you would watch for keeps.
By the way, I got into a John Hughes hole. It's so inspiring to hear how he wrote. He would write a fucking script in like a week, and to see how he would direct, and then he opened up his own goddamn music label to try to, because he was so into music that he was trying to provide the music for his own stuff. I would be so interested to see what type of movies he kept making. It's pretty phenomenal. But Back to the Future, when Rhodes, we don't need Rhodes, goes around, and the way that it flies up and it goes around, da, da, da. I worked with Zemeckis in a movie called The Walk. It took everything in my power not to ask him about Back to the Future, and then like last 3 days of filming, I just went bananas on him.
You're like, I have earned this, damn it.
Oh, yeah. And he was awesome. He was cool, and he like understood comedy. I would do a billion movies with him.
Ben, I gotta recommend, if you have not had a chance to check out the Criterion Collection edition of The Breakfast Club, it's got a special feature where they talk through all of John Hughes's notes for the writing of it. So you get to hear the like very
baby. Oh, that would be heaven.
Yeah, it's like the very baby ideas of what became the characters in like literal notebook pages. It's really cool.
There's a semi-doc and one of the bonus features of, it might be Planes, Trains, one of them has a John Hughes type little doc, and it's great.
The best. You are missed, John Hughes. He comes up very often on this podcast. Definitely wish he was still making movies and still with us. But that's a great way to lead to our final question, which is, if you could do a screening of a movie across the globe simultaneously for everyone, what movie would you pick?
But it's the same answer for all of them.
It's all Back to the Future.
Yeah, I guess the Home Alone would make people happy, I think. Home Alone, I remember Home Alone, that's like universally liked. If it was for everybody, I would pick a PG or under so kids could enjoy it. Man, I think Pixar probably has some of the best writing in the past 2 decades, by far, by the way. I think the scripts on Pixar films are so good. It is insane.
That's not entirely coincidence, because almost all of them are written by former Blacklist writers.
Is that true?
It is true.
I bet.
It is true. If you look at Victoria Strauss, Rashida Jones and Will McCormick, Michael Arndt.
What was on for Rashida? Celeste and Jesse Forever?
Celeste and Jesse Forever.
By the way, so one of the first things I came down when I first moved here, I never took a writing class. So I never took a class on how to write movies. I never took a class on how to write anything. So when I got here and I started to really want to go after it, I asked for a lot of scripts, and I asked for, I think like whatever the number one or two Blacklist script was for the past blank years, right? And I think The Muppet Man. Do you remember that script, The Muppet Man?
Yeah. Christopher Weeks, number one.
Dude, so I read that script and I was so blown away. There are also times when I'll read things or I'll watch a director do something and be so blown away that I'm like, what am I doing? Why am I even writing? Yeah. I'll get so upset at myself, or like Taika, watching Jojo Rabbit or watching a Taika film, like the fact that he can be so funny and so bring so much heart. And I was like, oh, I can never do that. And even like his camera choices, I was like, this is gorgeous. And it really bust me. But that Muppet film to me was like, that blew me away. I was so blown away by that. And the way that I literally learned how to write scripts was, I read Save the Cat. I printed out the outline of it and I would write all these things. My first ever movie I wrote was called Stripes versus Solids. And I worked at The Athlete's Foot, which is like a rival of Foot Locker. Yep. And it was about, you know, Athlete's Foot versus Foot Locker in the same mall. You know, I was 21 years old or whatever when I wrote it. I wrote that, and that got the attention of a guy named Adam F. Goldberg, who created the Goldbergs, and he loved it. And so he produced the next movie I did, and I wrote another script, and he gave me notes. So I was getting real notes from a real writer then. And it was just, you know, failing, learning, failing, learning, failing, learning. And then I sold Would You Rather, which is my first movie to Imagine. But that Muppet Man script blew my mind. I could not believe how good it was. I mean, I wonder if I revisited because it was like one of the first ever scripts I read. And also, it felt like a secret because to get a blacklist script, it's not like now where you like PDF it. You had to get the actual fucking hard copy.
The actual script. Yeah, yeah. It was still early.
It was like back in the day when you like make VHS tapes and pass them to your friends. Like, look at this cool thing nobody's ever seen but you. I remember being so excited when I got a script that nobody had seen before and I get to read it. It was so exciting to me. PDFs have ruined that.
Shout out to Christopher Weeks, author of the screenplay The Muppet Man, number one on the 2009 blacklist.
That's the year I moved to LA. That makes perfect sense.
There you go. What's wild is that he was still living in Australia when it was number one on the blacklist.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And obviously, like, because it's a Jim Henson biopic, there's rights issues to getting it made, and you need to get the Henson rights and the puppets rights. But yeah, it's an extraordinary script. Definitely one of those sort of like legendary things that may never get made.
Is the process of how you guys pick... So when I got on for El Fuego Caliente, what was the process of that for you two to pick who gets on the blacklist compared to now when it's a much bigger machine? Because back then, the rumor I heard was that agents' assistants would read it and then you would get their points of view. And I don't know how you got a point system out of it. So tell me how it was and how it is now.
It has never changed. The annual blacklist survey is identical to the way it was the first year that I did it in 2005. It is a survey of people's, specifically film executives. So no agents, no assistants. It's literally the executives at the major financiers and the production companies who have deals with them. And I'm asking them a very simple question. Give me a list of up to 10 of your favorite screenplays that haven't been produced yet as of the end of this year. And in exchange, you get the combined list. That's it. Super simple. And then we just count the number of times each script is mentioned. And obviously, we've built a lot of stuff up on top of that, including this podcast. But at the end of the day, the goal remains, let's highlight these things that everybody likes that for some reason they aren't making. And maybe we can make it more likely that they get made. So with that, we'll close out the conversation. Ben, thank you for joining us. As always, you are now sort of three of four with sort of the various blacklist opportunities. You've been on the annual.
I'm coming for you, Jay Ellis. You hear me? Wonderful, kind, wonderful actor, man.
You've been on the annual blacklist. Your script has been performed and you performed in the live reading of it. You've now done the podcast. Next step, a table read.
Yeah,
and
totally.
Then no one can touch you. It's like the five. It's like this SNL Five Timers Club.
Yeah, I get a jacket. You guys are going to give me a jacket, right?
We're going to get some hot silk jackets like I've been asking Franklin for years.
Kate's been lobbying for silk jackets for a while. I feel like that occasion might be the time to pull the trigger. So do the table read. We'll figure it out.
Of course. Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it. And thank you for looking out for me when I first started.
Thank you so much, Ben.
From Luminary, the Blacklist podcast is a production of The Blacklist and Ninth Planet Audio. Our executive producers are me, Franklin Leonard, Kate Hagen, Han Sani, and Jimmy Miller. Gabrielle Horton is our lead producer. Nicholas Patel composed our theme music, and this episode was edited and mixed by Kevin Liu. You can find me on Twitter at Franklin Leonard, at Franklin J. Leonard on Instagram. Kate is That Hagen Girl, girl, G-R-R-L, on both. And we, The Blacklist, are The, T-H-E, B-L-C-K-L-S-T.